Thank you for being here. I'm Rachel Brand with WilmerHale here in Washington. I'll be the moderator for today's panel. We've got a great event. This is sponsored, obviously, by the Federalist Society, which has a long history of bringing together diverse viewpoints about the most pressing legal issues of the day, and I think this event is no exception. And along those lines, I just want to remind everybody that the National Lawyers Convention is coming up November 18 through 20. It'll be here in D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel. And Dean tells me that there are brochures maybe out in the hallway, somewhere in the back of the room, and information on the website, too, if you want to check that out. It's a great event. I go every year, and if you've never been, you should give it a thought. The topic of today's panel, of course, is the upcoming Supreme Court term, which starts on Monday. Promises to be a very interesting term. The subject matter is fascinating and diverse. You've got everything from whether protests at military funerals are protected by the First Amendment, to a whole raft of preemption cases, to whether a federal court in California had the authority to order the release of about 40,000 inmates from the California prison system, and so on. And, of course, yesterday the court granted yet another case involving Anna Nicole Smith's inheritance, and so we all wait with bated breath to learn the outcome of that case and who gets the money. And Justice Kagan will make her first appearance on Monday. A new justice joining the court is always historic, but this will be the first time in history that three women sit together on the court, so yet another historic aspect to it. We'll all be watching with interest to see how she affects the court, and I hope that our panelists will comment a little bit on that today, how she'll vote, how active an oral argument she'll be, what impact her recusal from some of the short-term cases will have on the outcome of those cases, and so forth. We have a very distinguished panel to discuss this with us today. The format here will be 5 minutes of opening statements by each panelist, followed by some back and forth among the panelists. I may or may not ask some questions of the panel, and then we'll open it up to the floor for questions for hopefully half an hour. I've decided not to go into detail on the bios of our panelists because they're so distinguished that we'd be here all day, and so most of them are well known to you, and I'm just going to give a quick one-sentence version of what they're doing now, and then I'll open it up to Adam, who's our first panelist. So Adam Liptak is a Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, covering the Supreme Court and other legal issues for the Times. Ken Weinstein is a partner at O'Melveny & Myers here in Washington, handling white-collar cases and internal investigations primarily. Cannon Shanmugam, my law school classmate, and more importantly, Williams & Connolly partner here in D.C., working on Supreme Court and appellate litigation. We've got Jeff Rosen, who, among other things, is a law professor at GW Law School, and right now is working on a book about Justice Louis Brandeis. And then we've got Paul Clement, a partner at King & Spalding here in D.C., heading up their national appellate practice. Turn it over to Adam.
Thank you, Rachel. It's great to be here. I'm going to talk about the two cases of most interest to journalists because their facts are really easy to understand. The moment you tell them to people, they will form an opinion even before the legal analysis comes in. But the legal analysis matters because they're both difficult First Amendment cases. The first is the funeral protest case that Rachel mentioned called Snyder against Phelps. The facts are, I guess, appalling. A father is trying to bury his fallen Marine son and is confronted. The facts are, even at the Supreme Court, quite contested in the briefing, not superb. But protesters from a fringe church in Kansas, the Westboro Baptist Church, show up and protest with signs that say things like, God hates fags, and thank God for IEDs. Their theory seems to be that American tolerance of homosexuality has caused God to kill our soldiers. So the father sues in tort on the theories primarily of intentional infliction of emotional distress. And the question, and that's also an area of the law that's quite muddled, but in general so far the Supreme Court has been, has thought the First Amendment should play a role in that setting as well. And I guess the larger question in the case is, whatever you think of this speech, you might think it's lunatic, you might think it's vile or contemptible. Nonetheless, there may be other ways to restrict it. There may be content-neutral ways to restrict it. Many states and local governments have ordinances and laws that draw a cordon around funeral protests and keep everyone away. And the question in this case, I suppose, is whether you want to let a jury decide how much to punish speech that it dislikes. And that's a problematic thing, and that's an area in which, at least where public figure plaintiffs are involved, the Supreme Court has said the First Amendment plays a very substantial role. The leading intentional infliction case brought by Jerry Falwell was turned back on those grounds. But there, obviously, Falwell was a public figure, whereas Al Snyder, who I interviewed last night, is nothing like that and just can't understand what the First Amendment has to do with intrusion into a family's grief. So that's a case we argued on Wednesday that will get a ton of attention and really poses some difficult human and legal questions. The second case involves violent video games. California and many other states have tried this. All of them failed. The courts have uniformly struck down such laws. California passes a law that would impose a civil penalty on the sellers of violent video games to minors. And then the lower courts strike that down as well. It's unclear, really, why the court should take this case. It held it for the longest time. And then decided last year, United States against Stevens, which struck down a federal law that made it a crime to traffic in depictions of animal cruelty. The court saying they're not going to come up with a new category of speech outside the protection of the First Amendment. And there we were talking about, you know, actual harm, to quite brutal harm to actual animals. It was about speech on this question, not the conduct itself. The conduct itself is unlawful, everyone agrees. But can you, in the interest of suppressing the demand for animal cruelty, suppress speech about it? In the video games case, you're talking about perhaps things that are harmful to minors' psyches, but nobody's getting harmed in these video games except, you know, virtually. So the question is, having held this case through Stevens, you would have expected perhaps the court to grant vacate and remand and let the lower courts have another look at it in light of Stevens. Instead, they took the case, which is a curious thing, given there's no circuit split, and that it would require, in order for the court to rule against the video game makers, to come up with a new category of unprotected speech. This would be violence harmful to minors. It's clear that the states are free to regulate sexual conduct harmful to minors, but this would require an additional step. But for the fact that they took it, it's hard to know how to reconcile existing doctrine to what California wants to achieve in this case.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. I was asked, like everybody else here, to take a look at the docket and see whether there was a case or cases that looked particularly interesting, and as sort of an old violent crime prosecutor, in my eyes sort of glided right past preemption cases and the like and went straight to the case where there's blood on the sidewalk, and found one, and that's the case of Michigan versus Bryant. So what I want to do is just talk about that case, and that is a case about the application of the Confrontation Clause, and it's a follow-on from the Crawford versus Washington case of 2004. And I'd like to just dig in a little bit, with a little bit of depth here, because I think it's Crawford and its progeny and the case coming up this term really is an example of the court causing a sea change in a fundamental aspect of criminal litigation, which relates to the Confrontation Clause and when out-of-court statements, hearsay, statements made outside of the courtroom can be elicited in the courtroom without the declarant actually being there to be cross-examined. The case that we're dealing with here is, as I said, a blood on the sidewalk case. Police get called to the scene, and there's a man lying on the ground. His name is Covington. He's been shot several times, and he ultimately will expire because of his wounds. He says he was shot by a man named Rick, who lives six blocks away. The police go find Rick, arrest him. They then use Covington, the victim's statements at trial, to convict the defendant, Bryant, and obviously the victim's not there because he died. And the issue here is whether that violated the defendant's Confrontation Clause right to confront and cross-examine the victim about the statements that he made while he's lying there dying in the gas station saying that Rick is the one who shot me. The controlling authority back as of 1980 was a case called Ohio versus Roberts, which basically said, look, the Confrontation Clause, if taken literally, would not allow any out-of-court statements, any hearsay to come into court, and that can't be the case. So we have to take a more measured approach, and what we'll say is that an out-of-court statement can come in and it will not violate the Confrontation Clause so long as the judge determines that the statement is sufficiently reliable. That was the rule as of 1980. Many Prosecutors like myself spent many hours arguing the indicia of reliability of certain statements to get them admitted into court without the declarant being there. And that all changed, though, in 2004 with the court's opinion in Crawford versus Washington. The court basically just blew that analysis to smithereens and said that that reliability analysis by the judge is not sufficient. In that case, in the Crawford case, in short, you had a defendant's wife gave a statement to the police in the precinct that ended up incriminating the defendant. That got used in court. The court said, doesn't matter how reliable that statement is, that violated the husband slash defendant's confrontation clause rights. And Justice Scalia wrote what really was a brilliant opinion, went way back to the trial of Sir Walter Raleigh on charges of being involved in the plot against James I when he was prosecuted and convicted in part on the out-of-court statement of an alleged accomplice, and said that the common law development in this area, and ultimately the confrontation clause, was rooted in a desire to avoid that situation and to not allow the civil law practice of prosecuting somebody in court based on statements given to a magistrate outside of court. Based on that reasoning, the court found that eliciting that statement in the Crawford case was unconstitutional. The judge, Justice Scalia said, didn't matter whether the judge had found the statement to be reliable. That's putting the cart before the horse. As he said, the reality is the Confrontation Clause requires that the way of testing reliability is through cross-examination in court. It doesn't matter whether a judge found reliability on his own. As Justice Scalia says, dispensing with confrontation because testimony is obviously reliable is akin to dispensing with jury trial because a defendant is obviously guilty. So came down very hard on the side of the Confrontation Clause and definitively that the practice to date had been was not adequate, the practice under Ohio versus Roberts. The problem is Crawford didn't really explain what kind of statement is quote unquote testimonial. It's akin to testimony that cannot be allowed in evidence without cross-examination. Basically left that to subsequent case law. We've had a couple cases since then that have found opposite ways about whether or not a court statement violates the Confrontation Clause. And then the one in this term is the Bryant case. And the question's gonna be whether, going back to Mr. Covington, who's lying there on the ground with bullet holes in him, his statement to the police officers saying, Rick shot me, which is the kind of thing that happens in violent crime cases all the time and is a kind of statement that is absolutely critical to prosecuting those cases. Whether that was a statement that arose in the course of an emergency where the police were actually eliciting that information to try to address the emergency, or is the police trying to elicit that information in order to build a case? Because if it was the former, that wouldn't be considered testimonial, wouldn't be a Confrontation Clause problem. If it's the latter, it would be. Don't know which way it's going to go, but no matter which way it goes, it'll be based on reasoning that is diametrically opposite from the one that controlled our that analysis in our criminal courts for years up until Crawford. The final point I want to make, sort of more general point about this, is the following. This particular area where the court has been very sort of definitive and been very black and white about the application of the Confrontation Clause and excluding statements out of court, out-of-court statements from their admission in court, is seen by some as running very contrary to the trend of this court to be more permissive when it comes to the exclusionary rule in the Fifth Amendment and Fourth Amendment context, whereas this court has been accused of chipping away at the exclusionary rule and being more permissive of police misconduct and still allow evidence to come into court. Here they are, in this context, being very rigid about not allowing statements taken outside of court to be used against an accused. Obviously, there are differences. One is that the exclusionary rule that controls the Fourth and Fifth Amendment analysis is not in the Constitution, and the Confrontation Clause is. That, I think, is the most important factor. And also the exclusionary rule, which the court has found might not necessarily, or has suggested, might not be so needed to moderate police behavior. That police behavior component really isn't involved in the analysis for the Confrontation Clause because no one says that police shouldn't ask questions. The question is just whether the answers to those questions can be used in court without the declarant. So the answer, the question is going to be critical to Mr. Bryant, but it's also going to be critical to prosecutors around the country because this is going to help determine the viability of many violent crime prosecutions. And for I think the prosecutors around the country, they look at this dual approach that the court has taken on the exclusionary rule side and on the confrontation clause side as I think critics look at that and make it more, that makes it more difficult for critics of the court to typecast or stereotype the court as being pro-government or apologists for the police. On the part of prosecutors, I think they see that this is sort of one hand giveth and one hand taketh away, and the question is how much will be taketh away once this case is decided.
Thanks.
Okay, well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here with you today. Ken talked about the cases in which there's blood on the sidewalk, and I guess I'm going to talk about the cases in which there's money on the sidewalk. The case is of interest to the business community, and I would say that at least as the docket currently stands, there really aren't any particular blockbusters, at least from the perspective of the business community, but there are a lot of cases of medium impact, and so I'm going to focus on a couple of them, both of them securities cases, and then provide a 90-second tour through the court's preemption docket for the coming term as well. Let me start with those securities cases, and the first and I think the more significant is a case called Janus Capital Management versus First Derivative Traders that the court is going to hear in December. And in the interest of full disclosure, we filed an amicus brief on Janus's side on behalf of the legal industry. This is the court's third foray into the area of whether so-called secondary actors can be liable in securities fraud actions under Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 of the 1934 Securities Act. And in the two prior cases, the court rejected efforts to extend liability to secondary actors, first in a case called Central Bank versus First Interstate Bank, in which the court held that there is no private right of action under Section 10B on a theory of aiding and abetting liability, and more recently in a case called Stone Ridge versus Scientific Atlanta, in which the court rejected an effort to hold a counterparty to a commercial transaction liable as a primary actor under Section 10B for subsequent misrepresentations made by the party with which it transacted. Both of those cases were decided by very narrow margins. Central Bank was 5-4, and Stone Ridge was, I believe, 5-3, with Justice Breyer recused. And what has taken place, perhaps not surprisingly, is an effort on the part of plaintiffs, or perhaps more accurately in this area, plaintiffs' lawyers, to find ways of casting a broad net and holding secondary or ancillary actors potentially liable, particularly in circumstances in which the primary malefactor may not have the deepest of pockets. And so the Janus Capital case really presents yet another permutation on this question. It's a case involving misrepresentations allegedly made by Janus in its prospectuses for its mutual funds concerning market timing. And as some of you may know, Janus was caught up in a fairly high-profile controversy regarding the use of their funds for market timing. And what's going on in this case is that the plaintiffs are actually suing not the funds themselves, but the fund's investment advisors for liability on the theory that the investment advisors participated in the creation of the alleged misstatements. And the real question in the case is, at bottom, what does it mean to be a primary violator of the securities laws? What does it mean to be said to have made a misstatement for purposes of Section 10B and Rule 10B-5? Is it sufficient to have simply participated in the creation of the statements, or do the statements themselves actually have to be attributed to the actor for liability to attach? And this is an issue of significance not just to perhaps a somewhat narrow class of investment advisors, but also to entire industries such as the legal industry and the accounting industry, both of which have increasingly found themselves named as defendants in these types of actions. And I think most interestingly, the SEC, which had previously sided with the defendants in cases of this variety, have now taken the side of the plaintiffs and suggested that substantial participation in the creation of these statements is indeed sufficient to give rise to primary liability. So again, this is a case that's going to be argued in December, and it has the potential, I think, to have quite wide-ranging consequences in securities litigation. The other case I want to mention perhaps more briefly is a case called Matrix Initiatives versus Syracusano. And this case involves a somewhat narrower but still fairly significant question, primarily of significance to the pharmaceutical industry, which, as many of you may know, is increasingly finding itself on the receiving end not only of product liability litigation but also attendant securities litigation. And the question in this case is a fairly straightforward one. As you may know, pharmaceutical companies receive and are required to report to the FDA so-called adverse event reports whenever someone who takes their medicines suffers adverse side effects, really regardless of whether a causal connection is suspected or can be shown. And the question in this case is whether the failure to disclose those adverse event reports can give rise to a securities fraud claim on a theory of non-disclosure, absent an allegation and subsequent showing that the adverse event reports were themselves statistically significant. And this is potentially of some broader significance because it really touches on two of the most important elements of securities fraud claims, the materiality requirement and the scienter requirement. And while the Supreme Court has had a number of cases concerning the scienter requirement, the court really hasn't spoken to the meaning of the materiality requirement for many years. And so this is a case that has at least some potential to be of broader significance. And again, I do think it's noteworthy that the SEC in this case has indicated that it is going to side with the plaintiffs in the case, I think somewhat contrary to the more stringent scrutiny that the SEC had previously given to private securities fraud litigation in particular. So that's another case on the docket for the fall. I promised a 90-second rendition of the four preemption cases, and so while I'm not quite going to do these in haiku, it'll be pretty close. There are four preemption cases on the court's docket. Justice Kagan is recused from the last three that I'm going to mention because of her prior involvement in the cases while she was Solicitor General. The first, and I think in many ways the most interesting, is a case called AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion. While corporate America generally likes arbitration, it doesn't really like the concept of class-wide arbitration, I think in part because of the difficulty in obtaining judicial review of those decisions. And so increasingly in consumer contracts, there are waivers of class-wide arbitration provisions. Increasingly, courts have said that those waivers are invalid as a matter of state law, typically on the ground of unconscionability. And the question in that case is whether the Federal Arbitration Act preempts state law decisions that purport to invalidate those provisions. And given the ubiquity of these provisions in everything from cell phone contracts to automobile transactions, this is a case that will probably literally affect everyone in this room. Second is a case called Brusevitz versus Wyeth, and the question in that case is whether claims for defects in vaccines are expressly preempted by the Federal Vaccine Act. It's a relatively rare chance for the Supreme Court to opine on the scope of express rather than implied preemption. And interestingly, in this case, the government, which administers the Federal Vaccine Compensation Program, has actually sided with Wyeth, the manufacturer of the vaccine, notwithstanding this government's, this administration's somewhat anti-preemption tilt. Third, a case called Chamber of Commerce versus Whiting, which involves the preemption of an Arizona statute involving immigration. No, not that Arizona statute, but an earlier statute requiring participation in the federal E-Verify program. Federal law makes participation voluntary, and the question before the court is whether that judgment suffices to preempt the state law. And then finally, a case called Williamson versus Mazda, which involves a claim of implied preemption of a state tort claim regarding the failure by the manufacturer of a minivan to include a shoulder belt in the rear seat at a time when that was not federally mandated. This case will be of interest, I think, primarily because it's really the sequel to a case called American Honda Motor versus Geyer, which was really the high watermark of the court's preemption jurisprudence, and I think was in many ways the most aggressively pro-preemptive of the court's recent decisions. And this is a case in which the government has again really arguably changed sides. They were in favor of preemption in Guyer, which was a case that involved airbags, but they find themselves now on the other side in a case involving seatbelts. And so I invite you to, at your leisure, attempt to reconcile those two positions. Rachel?
Thank you, Cannon. Jeff?
I am a privacy junkie, and I was delighted to see that the court has agreed to hear two cases, which I'd like to talk about, involving personal privacy. And what makes these cases interesting is they don't involve the right to personal or sexual autonomy recognized in Roe and perhaps at the heart of the California gay marriage case. They involve a less debated but in some ways more significant right that the court recognized in 1977 involving the individual interest in avoiding the disclosure of personal matters. And we have just one or two constitutional cases on these rights and a statutory recognition of it in the FOIA case. In these two cases, lower courts have recognized rather expansive visions of the constitutional right for individuals and extended it to corporations in the statutory context, and the government is arguing for a narrow reading. So here they go. The first case, which will be argued on the second day of the term next week, next Tuesday, is Nassau versus Nelson. The NSA, NASA, requires employees, including contract employees, to undergo pretty intrusive background checks. They're asked about any adverse information about financial integrity, alcohol and drug use. There's a question about follow-up treatment if you've confessed to drug use, and also your friends and neighbors are asked if they have any adverse information about you. And a bunch of low-risk contract employees who were Caltech researchers sued, and they said this violated their constitutional right to informational privacy. I was interested about the history of this law. There's long been background checks on federal civil servants, but it was only in 2005, I learned from the briefs, that these were extended to include contract employees who'd previously been subject to background checks. I was confused about this because I watched Mad Men on Sunday, as I do most Sundays, and if you saw it just this past week, there Don Draper is a contract employee. He's basically hired to do ads for a huge aerospace firm in California, and he has to undergo a background check that threatens to reveal his secret identity and prove that he's not who he says he is. I don't know why he had to undergo that if this background check was only extended to people like that in 2005. The script writers.
Not everything you see on TV is true.
I don't know. When Mad Men, it must be true. That's my Bible. But anyway, you can see that these background checks are quite significant. So the Ninth Circuit said yes. Both the follow-up questions about drug use and also asking your friends and neighbors for adverse information violates a right that the court recognized in Whelan and Roe in 1977 involving informational privacy. And there was a very interesting dissent from our friend Judge Kaczynski, who faulted the court for not distinguishing between a whole bunch of different kinds of privacy, collection and disclosure of information, voluntary disclosure and compelled disclosure, and so forth. The big issue that the privacy community cares about is, will the court reaffirm the right recognized in Whelan and Roe and also in a case involving Nixon's private papers, the Nixon versus Administrator of General Services case, to say that there is a right to avoid unwanted disclosure of personal information. This is a right that the majority of circuits have recognized, but there just has not been much discussion of it since the Whelan case. Remember, that was a Brennan opinion. It involved medical information that had to be turned over to databases, and the court said you could require the disclosure, but only because there were protections against the sharing of the information. And there was one significant paragraph: we're not unaware of the threat to privacy implicit in the accumulation of vast amounts of government information in computerized data banks. The right to collect and use this data for public purposes is typically accompanied by a concomitant statutory or regulatory duty to avoid unwarranted disclosure. And because there was that duty in Whelan, then the collection was okay. So this case would be quite easy to decide, and I guess many people expect the court to decide it, on the grounds that unlike Whelan, the NASA, NASA, involves collection but not disclosure of information. And indeed, there's the court noted in granting cert that government agencies are prohibited by the Privacy Act from disclosing the information they've collected. So the easy thing to do would be for the court to say, yes, there is a Whalen-like right to avoid unwanted disclosure of personal information, but the information may be collected as long as there are adequate safeguards to protect against the disclosure. That would be that's what the government is arguing for, and that would be an uncontroversial opinion. There are some very interesting First Amendment aspects to the case. Some of the privacy groups have said that asking people intrusive information about their political affiliations might chill their First Amendment rights. I'll be interested to see whether Justice Kagan or any of the more privacy-minded justices bite at these claims, but I think no one expects them to go very far with a majority of the court. So that's the NASA case. The second case, which the court granted yesterday, is FCC versus AT&T. And here the question is statutory, not constitutional, and the question is, does the personal privacy recognized as an exemption to disclosure in FOIA apply to corporations? And obviously this is very fraught in the context of the Citizens United case last term, where the court held quite expansively that corporations have the constitutional rights of persons, and inquiring minds want to know whether that will command a majority when it comes to construing FOIA. So AT&T had contracted to provide equipment and services in schools, and then their competitors, AT&T's competitors, a trade association, sought the information under a Freedom of Information suit for their own competitive reasons. And AT&T invoked an exemption to FOIA for law enforcement records that could constitute an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. So once again, the statutory arguments could be decided fairly straightforwardly. The lower court, the Third Circuit, relying on the definition of person in the law that included corporations, said corporations, like human beings, face public embarrassment, harassment, and stigma because of their involvement in law enforcement investigations, and therefore they should be covered under this exemption. Now, it's true that FOIA does define corporations as persons in some preambulatory language, but it also defines state governments and other government entities as persons. When it comes to the construction of this particular FOIA exemption, in the past, lower courts had held that this language about personal privacy was supposed to be interpreted in light of a previous exemption, Exemption 6, which specified medical records and which had only been construed to apply to individuals and not corporations. So the lower court was kind of doing a fairly expansive textualist reading, not based on the pretty clear intent of Congress and not respecting the case law terribly carefully to expand this general protection of corporations in the preamble to this FOIA exemption. The government, General Kagan, filed the cert petition last year, and she said this would be quite disruptive because if this were upheld, then it would also subject to exemption not only corporations, but also state, local, and foreign governments and government components, and this would really upend FOIA enforcement and make it much harder to get information from government bodies that had been required to turn it over. Again, the straightforward, pretty modest opinion that the government is arguing for is just to not construe this particular exemption to include corporations. More broadly, I'm just struck by the fact, and I have to get this off my chest, none of the real privacy interests in these two cases are easily cabined under this informational privacy right or under FOIA. What we're really talking about is the right not to turn over embarrassing personal information in response to government investigations. This was the right that was recognized in the Boyd case in the 1890s when the corporation didn't have to turn over receipts for plate glass that would prove fraud. And the court in this opinion that my hero Justice Brandeis said was the high point of civil liberty in the late 19th century said, corporations don't have to turn over this embarrassing personal information because it's protected by the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, which run almost into each other. And we really, over the course of the past century, have had an abandonment of the idea that there might be some Fourth and Fifth Amendment interests in avoiding the disclosure of personal information. The court has held repeatedly, if you share information with a third party, you abandon all expectation of privacy in it. And that's really the nub of both of these cases. If that's going to be upheld, then it's pretty hard to stop asking intrusive questions about friends or getting the government not to turn over stuff that it's collected for another purpose. But those are the principles that are underlying these cases, and I would love it if just a few of the justices, and there, you know, Justice Thomas has been just as interested in these questions as Justice Breyer, understood that spirit and sought to give some protection for unwanted personal disclosures that are rooted not only in the Due Process Clause and not only in FOIA, but perhaps even in the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff. Paul.
Sure. Let me start with two quick bonus comments on the preemption cases. I think 90 seconds for four preemption cases is just not enough, but maybe that's my own perspective. The two bonus thoughts on the preemption cases are, one, I think since three of the four cases involve implied preemption issues, one case involves two, an express and an implied preemption issue, I think Justice Thomas will be a very interesting justice to watch. In the Wyeth case, he basically said that he's off the implied preemption boat entirely. You know, some people found that pretty surprising because in most of these cases, it's the more conservative justices that are finding implied preemption. You know, my own view is it's not that surprising. Justice Thomas doesn't like implied anything, doesn't like implied causes of action. He doesn't like implied constitutional provisions like the Dormant Commerce Clause, and maybe implied preemptions just like that. I think it'll be particularly interesting to watch him in the arbitration case that Cannon highlighted, because there's one where a lot of the arbitration cases in the Supreme Court have been decided 5-4, with the five more conservative justices voting in favor of arbitration. This case, which comes up as sort of an arbitration implied preemption case, I think it'll be very interesting to see whether Justice Thomas views it as an arbitration case or as an implied preemption case. The second thing I would say is Cannon highlighted that you could, if you have some extra free time, you might want to compare the government's brief in the Guyer case and its position in the Williamson case and try to figure out how they're reconcilable. I think as a bonus assignment, you might want to figure out how the government's position in the Williamson case is consistent with its position in the Whiting case, which is the Arizona immigration employment case. Because one of the issues there is in the Arizona case is there's a federal kind of ID check program, E-Verify, that is made by federal law voluntary. And as to that part of the case, what Arizona said is that it's mandatory for employers. So you have a voluntary federal program, but a state has made it mandatory. In the immigration context, the United States takes the position that that is impliedly preempted and even goes so far as to cite Guyer. In the Williamson case, by contrast, you have a federal regulation that says it's essentially voluntary for manufacturers whether they want to have a lap belt or, you know, a more elaborate seat belt. So federal law makes it voluntary. The state of California, through its tort law, makes it mandatory. And in that context, the federal government argues there's no preemption and distinguishes Guyer. So I think just, you know, so you can have a lot of fun with these preemption cases and consistency. The two cases I'd really like to talk about, one more extensively, one more briefly, are two cases that both involve what I would loosely describe as civil rights issues. The first is the Connick against Thompson case, which involves one of the great civil rights statutes, the Reconstruction era Section 1983 statute, and the circumstances in which there can be municipal liability under Section 1983. I think, you know, right up there with Adams' cases in terms of interesting facts, I think the facts of Connick against Thompson are really gripping facts. You have something that comes right out of a made-for-TV movie in the sense that you have an individual who is convicted for a robbery. The prosecutors have blood evidence that presumably would either show that he's absolutely the right person and therefore make their case easy, or would exonerate the defendant. The prosecutors essentially deep six the blood evidence, don't tell the other side that they even have the blood evidence. He's convicted for the armed robbery, and then in his capital case for a murder, an unrelated murder, essentially the prior conviction keeps him from taking the stand to defend himself. So he's convicted of capital murder. He's literally days away from potential execution when the suppressed evidence comes to light. Through the state processes, he is eventually exonerated, or at least not reconvicted, for both the armed robbery and the murder. So he's now a free man. If you think about this case, it involves one of the more kind of egregious Brady violations that you can imagine. The law is quite clear that you can't do perhaps the most obvious thing, which is just sue the prosecutor for the Brady violation, because the prosecutor has absolute immunity. So lawyers will try to figure out some way to provide compensation in this circumstance, and one avenue that appears to be open is the avenue of suing the municipality for failure to provide appropriate Brady training. And that's precisely what this suit involved. It went to the jury on that theory. There was a $15 million verdict against the city DA's office. The Fifth Circuit affirmed it in a panel opinion, then granted the case en banc, and then evenly divided. So there's no Fifth Circuit opinion in this case. The Supreme Court then took the case. And so the question in this case is really going to be whether or not there is a possibility for municipal liability under these circumstances. I think this case reminds me a great deal of the Pottawatomie County case that I argued last term, in which I think on the one hand, there certainly are going to be instincts on some justices that it ought to be very difficult to sue prosecutors. But on the other hand, when confronted with truly egregious facts, there is also a countervailing impulse to try to find some way to provide a degree of compensation for somebody whose constitutional rights have clearly been violated. The second case I'll mention is a case that Rachel alluded to. This is the California prisons case. This is the case where, for the very first time since the Prison Litigation Reform Act was passed, that there is a case that has come to the Supreme Court under the mandatory appellate provision in that statute, a provision I have to say I was actually unaware of, was kind of snuck into the bill. But it is a provision that basically says that if there is a so-called prison release order, that first, you have to convene a three-judge panel, and second, if the three-judge panel orders that relief, there's a direct appeal to the Supreme Court. So the first time the Supreme Court has heard one of these cases, I'm representing one of the classes of plaintiffs in that case, so take my description of the rest of the case with a grain of salt. But I would say this is a case that could only arise in California. California is in a state of, you know, severe budgetary difficulty, and one of the few things that California can still do is pass tough on crime laws, because it doesn't take any money immediately to pass those kind of laws. And so it has incarcerated a great number of people, and that is, while they have the money to pass three strikes laws and very unforgiving parole and probation laws, they don't have money to build additional prisons. So the California prisons have become overcrowded to a degree that I think it's fair to say is really a complete outlier. So the California prison overcrowding levels are much higher than in any other jurisdiction in the country. And so the question becomes, given these budgetary difficulties, there's very little prospect of the political process sort of solving this. In one of these cases, there has been a constitutional violation that's been found and reaffirmed for 15 years, requiring California to do more to provide adequate medical care. And the question in these cases is really, I think in some respects, whether you can ever have this kind of prison release order, or you can ever have this kind of cap, or whether, in fact, even though the PLRA says that you, at least implicitly, says that you can have this kind of order because it provides for relief under these circumstances, whether effectively this is just a bridge too far in terms of remedying the constitutional violation. I think in some ways it's an interesting case because on the one hand, it may seem like the obvious answer here for a conservative is to say that of course you can't have this kind of release order. On the other hand, if you think about the Prison Litigation Reform Act, what it was principally directed at was the kind of micromanagement of prisons in long-standing, decades-long consent decrees, where every aspect of the prison, from, you know, how many hot pots to have in a particular wing versus, you know, the temperature of the bathwater, was regulated by a federal judge. And in an odd way, this kind of release order actually provides a more limited role for the federal government and a more in the way of choice, actually, for the states, because the way that the order in this case works is it basically caps the population at a particular percentage level. How the state gets there, whether it gets there by sending prisoners to out-of-state prisons or uses, you know, for-profit prisons, or whether it changes its probation and parole rules to get less people incarcerated, all of that's essentially up to the states. And so in maybe a counterintuitive way, there's a way in which this kind of order, unlike some of the classic consent decrees, actually gives the states a little more of a role in administering their own prisons.
Thank you, Paul. I think what we'll do next is go down the row again here and ask each of the panelists if they have any rebuttal or observation about what the other panelists have said, and try to keep it to a minute. Adam?
I cede my time.
Okay, well, wow, okay. Ken?
Same here.
Same.
Cannon?
I think I would just say one thing. You know, we've all been inculcated in this notion that the Supreme Court consists of these two blocks of four justices, with Justice Kennedy now the presumptive justice in the middle. I think that the area of the law that Adam talked about and the area of the law that Paul and I talked about are really exceptions to that rule. I think in the First Amendment area, we have a court that is pretty protective of speech rights, and arguably with Justice Kennedy kind of in the vanguard of that effort. And so it will be very interesting to see what the court does in the two cases Adam mentioned. But, you know, I think you almost have to start from the presumption that the side seeking to vindicate First Amendment rights is likely to prevail. I think in the area of preemption, as Paul mentioned, you know, Justice Thomas's opinion in the Wyeth versus Levine case really was kind of one of those eureka moments. It kind of reminded me of when Justice Blackmun said he was no longer going to tinker with the machinery of death. You had Justice Thomas saying he was no longer going to tinker with the machinery of preemption. And this is an area of the law in which I really don't think that traditional right-left labels are very accurate guides. And it will be very interesting to see where Justice Kagan, who, after all, was most recently Solicitor General Kagan, arguing for preemption at most, if not all, opportunities, comes out on these issues. We'll probably have to wait a year or two before we get a good sense of that, given her recusals and the many preemption cases on the court's docket.
Okay. Jeff?
Well, maybe just on that point, because it was so much at the center of the Kagan hearings, it's true that the business cases tend not to be ideologically divided. And the numbers were recently run. The Chamber of Commerce found that 80% of the cases in which it had filed briefs were decided unanimously, or nearly so, at least by 7-2 or unanimously. On the other hand, there is a sharp ideological division in the 5-4 business cases, and liberal groups during the Kagan hearings made a great deal of the fact that the five conservatives were much more pro-business in those divided business cases than the four liberals. They're frustrated that there's been no economic populist on the court in the tradition of William O. Douglas. They don't think that any of the current liberal justices are determined to stick it to the corporations in the way that Douglas was, and Kagan's performance and all that will be relevant. And just seeing whether, of course, the First Amendment consensus collapsed in Citizens United because there was that corporate tinge. I wonder, too, there's a bipartisan consensus for privacy often as well, but you could see that dividing, both given the substantive due process overlay in the NSA case and also the concern about extending the rights of corporations generally in the AT&T case. So I wouldn't overstate the unanimity in many of these cases, which have cross-cutting impulses, but it's true that they may not all divide along familiar lines.
Yeah, I want to take my minute to ask Ken a question, which is, I think if we were under the kind of, you know, the Ohio against Roberts reliability old hearsay rules kind of regime, it would be very important in that case that the potential witness was a dying declaration and the potential witness was no longer available. Does that matter under the kind of testimonial test, or is the answer the court going to provide here? If they say this is testimonial, will it be equally testimonial if you have somebody who gives this kind of declaration to the police but then, you know, doesn't die and, you know, could just as easily be called?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think that the dying declaration argument was one that was floated down below, but it wasn't preserved. So I think it came in as an excited utterance, and that's how it came in and has been litigated up. But I believe the dying declaration is something which, even though it would be testimonial, and I think the courts have said, though testimonial, because it's such a traditional exception in which, you know, courts have historically allowed these statements to come in because the person died, that exception, unlike all the others, might actually survive the Crawford decision. So it might be that if you actually have a violent crime case that is a homicide case as a prosecutor and the person dies, you might be lucky in the sense that you'll still be able to get a testimonial statement where the person wasn't an emergency, wasn't dying, expiring, and giving the information to help the police, you know, or help the medics help him or whatever, but in fact was maybe giving the police with full awareness that he was providing this information to build a criminal case down the road, that information might still be able to come in because of the dying declaration. It's interesting. It's sort of an artifact, and I'm curious as to sort of what the sentiment is behind possibly preserving that, other than the thought that, you know, there's one type of statement that should be able to come in, it's the one where the person's giving the incriminating information with his last gasp. So.
Well, I'd like to ask one question of the panelists before we open it to the floor. So if each of you has three or four sentences or a minute about Justice Kagan, what you'll be looking for, what impact you predict her to have, or anything else you want to say about that?
Well, from the reporter's perspective, you know, we like color and we like conflict, and she's a very able, funny person with a lot of charm, and I will be surprised if we don't have more vigorous questioning throughout the argument than we used to get from Justice Stevens, who would save his one exquisite question for the end. And it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't pain me, again, as a journalist who seeks conflict, to see if some of the tension that seemed to exist between Chief Justice Roberts and then Solicitor General Kagan were to transfer up onto the bench as well.
Do you expect her to be active on the first day, or deferential, or what do you think?
You know, who knows? But if the Sotomayor experience is some guide, the new justice might feel some need to get some questions out early to make clear that they're present, and it's also in her nature. She's very good. She's very quick. She's going to bring a lot of ideas to the bench when she's there. She will, of course, be absent about half the time in the early part of the term, at least.
Okay. Ken.
Just in the criminal context, it'll be interesting to see how aggressive she is, and I guess the only measure I have is I studied closely the Humanitarian Law Project, the Holder case, and her work in that case. She was quite aggressive, and in a case where, I mean, the atmospherics were kind of sympathetic to the other side. Here you had peace organizations who were trying to go out and help terrorist groups become peaceful groups, and they were concerned that they were exposed to possible prosecution under the material support statutes. And so it was a case where I think sort of there was some question about whether that would test the mettle of the administration in terms of their focus on the effort against terrorism. They obviously went, they took the pro-enforcement side of it, and she was quite aggressive in her advocacy. So based on that, I guess I'm, from a, you know, if you're looking at it from a law enforcement perspective, I'm inclined to think that she'll carry that through as a justice as well.
Kenneth?
Well, having talked about a couple areas of the law in which the court is not always predictably divided, there are obviously other areas in which it historically has been. And I think that the real question, not just for the coming term, but going forward, is whether Justice Kagan will emerge as the intellectual leader of the so-called left of the court, a position that Justice Stevens had, I think, fairly occupied for many, many years, not least as by far the most prolific opinion writer on the court. And I think that there is some uncertainty as to who that person will be. And, of course, it may vary from area to area. But I think the real question is just how assertive she will be in serving as the intellectual force behind that group.
Okay. Jeff?
I think that's right, and I'd maybe add to that the question is not only will she be an intellectual leader, but will she fulfill liberal hopes that she is, in fact, the Messiah? because there is such hunger, and candidly, no surprise to my friends at the Federalist Society, such frustration from liberals expressed openly, why can't we have a Scalia who is not only able to redefine the terms of debate, but also able to articulate this positive vision? And frustration that despite the great respect in which the other justices are held, Justice Breyer has this wonderful new book, which is so compromising and so pragmatic and so accommodating. And Justice Ginsburg, again, I'm just channeling my progressive friends, a wonderful heroine, but so minimalistic. And Justice Sotomayor asks all those good questions, but really doctrinally quite cautious in her first year and didn't really issue very many separate opinions at all. So the expectations are so high for Kagan. First, she has to be the intellectual leader. Second, she has to be the conciliator who's using her tremendous charm to win over Justice Kennedy whenever she can. And third, she has to redefine the goals of liberalism and articulate a positive progressive vision for the 21st century. Now, no one thinks more highly of Elena Kagan than I do. I just have very high expectations myself. But I have, frankly, no idea whether she'll be able to meet any or all of these expectations, because everything in her past has not really disposed her to take on a role of this boldness. But it's definitely possible. I hope she does do it, and I'm going to be watching as avidly as the rest of you.
Paul.
Jeff, it sounds like a couple of those are mutually exclusive. So
that's the point. Well, welcome to the progressive side.
No, no thanks.
There's plenty of room at the table.
In any event, I guess what I would say is I think what's interesting about the Kagan appointment is that it is the first time since Justice White served on the court that you have a democratically appointed by a Democratic president, justice with extensive executive branch experience. And I think, you know, for the past couple of years, executive branch experience has been a defining feature of the backgrounds of a number of the Republican appointments to the court. You know, Justice Scalia, most notably, you know, in terms of his OLC experience, and then the two most recent appointments as well, Justice Thomas as well, and really, you know, so of the four most conservative justices, all of them have had extensive executive branch experience. And so I think that what that means to have somebody on, you know, presumably on the other side of the court, but with that same shared experience, whether that is going to translate, as I think some progressives fear, that she may be sort of pro-executive on some separation of powers issues, whether that is going to translate into being maybe a more available vote, or maybe comparable to Justice Breyer, but not so much Justice Ginsburg, on issues of preemption. Because of that experience, I think all of those are very interesting things to keep an eye out for, because I do think that that sort of not having a monopoly of prior executive branch service on kind of one side or the other of the court is probably a healthy thing for the institution. And I guess as an optimist, I say, I hope it will kind of leaven the debate on some of these issues.
Thank you. I'm going to stand up so I can see the whole audience. We have time for questions from the floor? Okay, will you give me the signal when we're down to the last question? Okay. So, open it to the floor for questions. Over here. Oh, we have a microphone, I'm told. It's coming around.
I am Jordan Lawrence with the Alliance Defense Fund, and we're working on the Arizona Tuition Tax Credit case. And I would just be curious for your any opinions on whether you think the court is going to resolve the issue on the standing grounds or on the Establishment Clause grounds, and what's the significance of it that they granted two cert petitions that present two pretty significant but very different issues.
Are you directing that at any particular
panelist? Anyone in particular.
Panelist? Should I call on somebody? Paul, do you have a thought about that?
I sort of know something about the case, and have talked to Jordan about the case. I do think that it's striking, and if my memory serves, there are actually three petitions filed in the case. Is that right? Originally, and the court granted two of the three petitions. They granted the state's petition, and it's, you know, the state's program that's at issue, so that's sort of obvious. And I do think it's significant that with kind of two kind of other non-state petitions, that they granted the petition that was the only one, I think, that raised the standing issue. And, you know, if you look at Supreme Court Establishment Clause cases, you don't have to look at them very hard to realize that the standing issues and the merits issues are not two things that are just worlds apart. Oftentimes, you know, the standing issues, essentially are the merits. I mean, that's most obvious in a case like the Hine against Freedom from Religion Foundation, where you're talking about taxpayer standing, which is really a doctrine that exists only in Establishment Clause cases. But it was also obvious in a case like the Buono, the Mojave Desert Cross case last term, where there were two principal reasons why the court could not produce a majority opinion. One was that it was an Establishment Clause case. And that seems to just, of its own force, preclude a majority opinion for the court. But the second reason was that in that case, Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas broke off from the other justices that ended up concluding in a place that was favorable to the cross continuing to stand, but they ruled exclusively on standing grounds. So I think you could potentially have something similar going on in this case, where justices actually peel off on the standing ground or see that as the important issue in the case, and other justices are anxious to get to the merits.
Okay. Jean.
I'm curious on the privacy cases. Are there some of the medical privacy cases working their way toward the court? Does anyone know? And I guess particularly for Jeff, how do those cases mix in to your general analysis on privacy cases?
I don't know what's working its way up, so my colleagues can inform us, but I gather that those are primarily statutory cases, and in some ways the NASA case is unusual in having its constitutional roots, the right to avoid disclosure. If the court reaffirms Whalen in NASA, maybe the medical privacy cases will get an extra constitutional edge. But broadly, my colleague Oren Kerr at GW has observed this, and it's really right. Most of the great advances for privacy law in the post-war era had been statutory and not constitutional, from the electronic privacy to email privacy and so forth. So I'd expect those to continue in that reign, and that's something that hasn't been ideologically divided, and that's why I'll be so interested to see whether the second case, the FCC case, has this new pattern of conservative textualism interpreting privacy broadly in that case to thwart the will of Congress, and I wonder how that would play out in the medical privacy cases too. But I think they're statutory. And does anyone know if any are working their way up?
I think there's one case which doesn't directly involve medical privacy, but that I could see getting to the Supreme Court sooner rather than later. There's a question involving the availability of damages under the Federal Privacy Act, and there's actually a circuit conflict on the availability of those damages. You may recall there was a fairly high-profile case involving the VA losing a laptop that contained information on thousands of veterans. The government won on the argument as to whether there are damages in the 11th Circuit, but then lost in a relatively recent 9th Circuit case. The government filed a petition for en banc, which is usually a sign that the government will seek cert if that is denied, but that petition has been pending, I think, for about 5 or 6 months in the 9th Circuit. Without action. The Ninth Circuit has a lot of other things on its plate at the moment, and that may be why, but in any event, if that petition is denied or if the panel's decision is effectively affirmed by the en banc court, I would not at all be surprised if that case makes it to the Supreme Court probably next term.
Okay, anybody else on that one? Any other questions? In the back there.
A question for Mr. Liptak about the Entertainment Merchants versus California case.
Yes.
Obviously, creating a new category of speech different from obscenity would be one thing, but if I recall correctly, pornography for young people is what's made illegal, even though it's otherwise protected by the First Amendment. So could you talk about how the fact that this is specifically minors
yes.
might be different?
Right. So there are two wild card factors in this case. One is that violence is a category that the court has never embraced as the sort of thing that the government can regulate or suppress. And the second, though, is that in the context of children, even relatively mild pornography sold to minors can be regulated. So California, that's a case called Ginsburg. California is pushing that point of view quite hard and saying that all of the thinking behind that in the context of sexual content ought to be available as a basis for state regulation of violent content. And it's probably true that the Ginsburg case didn't have a ton of social science behind the idea that sexual materials are harmful to minors. At the same time, California all but concedes that the studies that it has show correlation but not causation, which is to say it's probably true that kids who do violent things play violent video games. But that may be because they have a taste for violence, not because the violent video game is causing them to be violent.
Anyone else? Is there a hand? Oh, I'm sorry, right there.
This is a question for Mr. Weinstein. When you had been talking about Kagan's positions as Solicitor General as a good predictor of where she might come out on the court, particularly with respect to the more aggressive position taken sort of pro-law enforcement in the terrorism cases. How much do you think could be attributed to the fact that, you know, as Solicitor General, she is in fact required to take the administrative's position, the administration's position? I mean, the canons of professional ethics do require you to aggressively represent your client, and as long as your client doesn't want you to take an illegal or unconstitutional position, that's what you're supposed to do. Whereas on the court, presumably she has no master other than what she thinks is the right constitutional and legal thing to do.
No, I think you make a very good point. There's a limit to how much you can read into her future decision-making on the court based on what she did as Solicitor General. I think, you know, we have somebody here who could give you some insight about that, but I think you have a job, you have a position that you have to advocate, and you go and you know, as an attorney, it's your ethical duty to advocate as effectively and zealously as you can. I guess what I'm thinking is, based on the fact that she doesn't have a long track record in criminal justice issues, the one thing I was able to look at as a measure was how she handled that case, and the fact is that it was a case where I think some people thought maybe the administration would take a different tack and maybe not take an aggressively pro-law enforcement position. That position was taken. I can't say whose voice was behind that decision-making, whether it was she or others. But the way she handled the case, I thought, was effective and strong. And so to the extent that that's any measure of how she'll be on similar issues in the future, it could give somebody from the pro-law enforcement perspective some comfort.
I actually have a question I want to ask Paul, which this just reminded me of. Do you think that there will be any impact at all? Is it still the case that there's no nominee for Solicitor General?
That's my knowledge. Do
you think that the absence of a confirmed SG or even a nominated SG will have any impact on the way that the SG's office appears before the court or any other effect?
Well,
don't you think they've nominated anyone yet?
Well, that's a different question. let me answer your first one. I don't think it makes... I mean, it's obviously always better in every government position to have somebody confirmed in that position. That's my belief, and I think, you know, it's backed by Congress's belief. That's why we have a Vacancies Act and things like that. I mean, I think it's always... you both, in terms of the public accountability for the office and the proper role for the Senate, I mean, I think always should be a preference for having confirmed officials rather than people serving in an acting capacity. That said, I mean, I was acting Solicitor General for nearly a year, I did not perceive any difference in terms of how the work of the office was perceived by the court in that year versus, you know, my prior 3 years working under a confirmed Solicitor General or the following 3 years working as the confirmed Solicitor General. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, the Solicitor General's office, draws on literally, you know, decades of kind of experience and credibility. And so I don't think you can kind of wear down that or have to worry about anything if you just, you know, operate without an acting, you know, if you operate without a confirmed Solicitor General for even a full term of the court. You know, that said, it surely, for the reasons I said at the beginning, is a good thing, and I think shows, a full degree of respect for the court for you to move expeditiously towards having a nominee and move forward with the confirmation process.
And you intentionally avoided my second question, I gather.
Indeed.
Okay.
Quite intentional.
Got it. Okay.
Willful, even.
anybody, any other questions from the floor? There's one hand back there.
No one else asked, I don't think, but is the court going to get either the Arizona immigration case this year, noting that it's coming up through a preliminary injunction context, or is it going to get the Proposition 8 case? And easiest of all, how do they come out?
Okay, who wants to take that? Adam, you look pensive, like you want to say something.
The Prop 8 case will probably sit around in the Ninth Circuit for a good long time. And from the perspective of the proponents of same-sex marriage, that's a good thing for them. The more time they have, the more they slow walk their case, the better off they are. I don't know about the immigration case. That depending on the twists and procedural turns that might take, it's possible for that to reach the court much more quickly.
Any other thoughts, Cannon or?
Tough for it to make it for this term, though, absent some sort of extraordinary expedition. So probably more likely for next term.
Okay. Anybody else? Let me ask one last question then of the panel. Do you predict that President Obama will get another vacancy on the court in his first term in office?
I think the conventional wisdom now is probably no, that the likely person about whom one who springs to mind is Justice Ginsburg, who did have some health issues and who did just lose her beloved husband. But she seems fully committed to the job, is telling people she wants to stay, seems to be in good health, was back on the bench, didn't miss a day after her surgery, was back on the bench the day after her husband died. I have no inklings that anyone else is even in the mix. If Justice Ginsburg were to go, you'd think she'd have to go this year, not in the election year. And I, you know, the thinking seems to be, although nobody knows it except for the justices themselves and perhaps not even them, but I would guess that we're entering a period of some stability now.
I think the only people who really know are the justices and their personal doctors, and while my wife is a doctor, she doesn't treat any of the justices, or at least if she does, she doesn't tell me.
Jeff?
I interviewed Justice Ginsburg over the summer, and she looks great, and she seems determined to stay.
Paul?
Yeah, I'm. You know, I don't think Justice Scalia is planning on stepping down this summer, so.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you to our panelists. This was great. Appreciate it. Thank you all for being here.